From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The center recently convened a discussion of the practice of medicine today, with attention to the humanistic and ethical aspects of the physician's art, as much as to the clinical and technical elements of modern medicine. Soundings now presents an excerpt from that discussion. The speakers are Dr. Thomas Ballantyne, professor of surgery at Harvard Medical School, Dr. John Kernute, research fellow in pediatrics at Harvard Medical School and the Sidney Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, William Bennett, chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, Dr. Chase Peterson, vice president for health sciences at the University of Utah, and Dr. Alan Dyer, a professor of psychiatry at Duke Medical Center and a scholar at the National Humanities Center.
The problem that American medicine faces as a whole, as I see it, is that it is being besieged on all sides by society, saying, what are you guys going to do about this, and what are you going to do about that? Now, you, Bill Bennett, tended to shrug your shoulders about the tough ethical decisions and say they don't occur very often, and that therefore we are emphasizing them too much. I would agree with that, except for one thing, that those are the decisions that get the attention of the public, and the image of the physician is molded by his pronouncements about these tough ethical issues. And he becomes a technician, interested only in cutting as much as he can and putting people on machines, or he's a humanitarian, and that sort of thing. And it's the it is the perception of the public that is molded by asking the physicians to address hard ethical decisions. But do you think I'm wrong about that?
John Kernute?
I'd just like to make one brief comment, not to expound on that. I would have to agree with Dr. Ballantyne in that I think a physician's ethical conflicts have a lot to do with where he or she is practicing medicine. My own experience has been in a major pediatric center in Boston, a big referral center, and also in a major cancer referral center. And I found that day in and day out over the last 3 or 4 years of my life, I mean, I've been faced with these kinds of decisions every day, the ones that Bill was referring to as being the very difficult ones. I mean, I would agree with Bill in that I don't think they're quite as difficult as people make them out to be, because you have to do something, and sooner or later you develop an internally consistent way of facing these problems. You keep your mind open for new ways of looking at it, but you deal with them a lot. If you're in practice in a small town and you know, you see mostly pneumonias and infectious disease of that sort, then you know the number of ethical conflicts you're going to have will be a lot fewer. Dr. Ballantyne is a neurosurgeon, and I'm sure in his day in and day out life, he sees an enormous number of ethical problems.
Now, another thing, my father was a general practitioner in Oklahoma, and sure, he treated colds and sore throats and cuts and bruises, but there wasn't a week that went by that he did not face someone who was dying. And not a month that went by, or 2 months, John, because he did obstetrics as well as general practice, that he didn't have to deal with a problem in infancy. And that's why I started off by saying it's the beginning and the ending of life that has the public confused, and they look to the doctors for answers, and the way they perceive the answers to the doctors will be the way they perceive the medical profession.
I don't want to diminish. I mean, it would be ridiculous and contradictory to diminish the importance of what are obviously very important issues. My question, I guess, is more maybe in some ways sociological, and it gets back to some things that Chase was talking about. I'll ask Chase if he would to say something. This whole kind of ethical fever, if you don't mind, that's upon us, onslaught on the medical profession and other professions about its ethics. Has it been for good or for ill? Has it made the profession more ethical? Has it made the practice of medicine better? And a second question, or part of that question, are doctors, do they make better, more conscientious decisions left to themselves, or in consultation with a wide range of visiting firemen from philosophy, theology, and the like? Chase, would you take any piece of that?
The second part, would doctors make better decisions if they were more widely exposed? I'm sure that we would all benefit by wide exposure, but exposure to the development of a thought process more than exposure just to a line of to a position. By that I mean to me, ethics is based on what you learn in childhood, plus what a very wise teacher can guide you through, which is to take a situation and think it through to its logical conclusions. And a lot of people are quote, unethical, end quote, only because, however benign they might be at any point, they don't follow through to logical conclusions, and therefore the results are unethical, even though they didn't intend it that way. Let me try to answer the first by, or respond to the first, by asking John to repeat what you mentioned at the break, John, and maybe Tom also, from different generations. Where did you learn your ethical standards, or how was it that you developed a capacity to make difficult judgments quickly when there wasn't time for an appeal to much of anyone else? Your example, John, was in the middle of the night, a 2.2-pound baby is dropped in your lap. Where do you learn that?
Well, again, I think it's the way you're brought up gives you a frame of reference in which to make those types of decisions. In medical school, people focus on that as a major point or a major arena where one learns to do these. I, in my experience, didn't find that to be true. Pretty much medical school was a time of getting the vocabulary of medicine down, learning the basic scientific principles underlying it, learning the fundamentals of getting a history, doing a physical exam, and some basic pharmacology and treatment principles. It was not until I became a house officer or an intern or resident that I really had to face these types of issues, and I'm sure all the other physicians in our group here would agree with that too. I found that in my pediatric training, which preceded my work in cancer, that during the day, say in an intensive care unit at a referral hospital, we would have attending physicians, people who had been carefully selected by the hospital to be on the staff, who were pretty much our role models. These people, for the most part, I could look up to as being good men and women, well educated in the science of pediatrics, and as many babies are born during the day as the night, and you would see them in during the day help you make decisions about the very premature infant, the infant with maybe a non-repairable cardiac lesion or a cardiac lesion that was repairable but at extreme risk to the baby. Slowly, and actually sometimes it happened very quickly, you would begin to get a sense of how these people applied their basic upbringing to these types of problems. And very shortly after that, into my second year of residency training, I would then be the senior physician in the intensive care unit at night, and then very quickly on my lap would be dropped the small baby. The baby would be extremely ill, for example, and the decision about whether that baby should go on to live would pretty much have to be made within, say, 2 o'clock in the morning and 6 o'clock in the morning when there was no senior physician there. A person, of course, who would be available by telephone, but sometimes you don't even have time to walk to the telephone to make the call. And it's a very different experience than anything that any ethics course I ever saw could teach, because there's something about being there with your hands on the situation that in having just talked to the mother, having just talked to the father, looking at this baby, and just taking all of the intangibles in the circumstance that help you make the decision. And what would go through my mind is, what would I do if this were my baby? What would an attending physician whom I looked up to, how might that person make the decision? And I think it's during that period of time that you take those fundamental values that you're raised with and then sort of mold them into certain medical types of problems. And every single situation is different. There's no way to sort of have a textbook and say, this is what you do for premature babies, this is what you do for a brain damaged child, this is what you do for a child with leukemia. You just have to have a basic framework to operate in.
So the outcry over ethics in physicians, people are asking physicians to come up with a theory of ethics, and that's impossible, is that right? Because it all comes down to individual cases?
Well, I think the study of ethics is important because there's something to be learned there. And I think that's, Dr. Peterson had mentioned how there is this cry among physicians to bring in the philosophers to try to teach us something, and I think there is something that we can learn. But I think we have to have reasonable expectations what we're able to learn from the philosophers. I find Bill Bennett, for example, who is a philosopher, to have an extremely clear way of thinking. And in our many discussions about medical problems, he's been useful to me in showing me a type of reasoning discipline in approaching ethical type problems, political, medical, whatever we happen to be talking about, that is very useful. And I think in ethical courses, this is what the physician can learn. But I don't think you're going to learn the answers to particular circumstances.
Alan, Dyer?
Yeah, I wanted to make some comments about the issue of etiquette and the criticism that the medical profession is under, because there are, of course, very important ethical dilemmas that the physician faces. And the matter of etiquette is also very important in the kind of day-to-day kinds of questions.
What do you mean by etiquette? Just the way doctors treat
manners,
patients?
Habits and ways of interacting. Mm-hmm. I recall one colleague recently telling me an anecdote about his mother, who was terribly incensed that the doctor had called her by her first name and chose another physician. And one might say, well, this is a very small matter. But it discloses something of the relationship of the doctor to the patient, and that the doctor would assume either that he should call a patient by the first name or not call the patient by the first name, because other people might feel differently about that. These things become important matters to patients. And I think the medical profession, we're talking about criticism. We need to be attentive to the kinds of criticisms that we're getting, because we don't always live in the same communities as our patients. We haven't grown up with them as once might have been the case and known them over decades and generations, so that we could assume that the manners or the morals that we held would be those that our patients would hold. And I think that's one of the things that physicians are often criticized for, the idea that the physician thinks he knows best or thinks she knows best. And patients sometimes want more control over their lives and need more control over their lives. It may be a simple matter of communication to say, what is it you want? How can I help you? We may take that for granted, but I think it's important to keep in mind.
Bill Bennett has a comment, but first let me just say, in this trust, isn't that what you're talking about? Just the fact that
it is trust, and that is what I'm saying, and that we need to be attentive to how do we build trust, because that is an important ingredient of the healing process.
Bill?
Well, I just a thought. I sniff a bit of conspiracy here, not in this room, but in this sort of indictment of the profession. I remember, Alan, one of the first times we had the chance to talk, we spoke about this. You know that if you ask a large part of the American people what they think of the American Congress, they will say not much. If you ask them then what they think of their particular congressman, they'll say not bad, for the most part. A very similar sort of thing, I think, would happen if you ask people about doctors and then ask them about their doctor. And I don't want to reduce this to the level of triviality, but again, you know, what is it that really bothers people about doctors? When I've talked to people about this, this concern about ethics, the thing I keep coming up with is things like, well, you come in and you have to wait 2 or 3 hours, you know, and they can't see you when you want to see them. But I find among some intellectuals and among some journalists this sort of very deep criticism and hostility toward the medical profession. But I must say, I don't find it so widespread among what we might call regular citizens. Most people still go to doctors, I think. Most people still trust their doctor. They may be inclined in a fit of sophistication to repeat what they say in the paper about the profession, as we might say about Congress. But is there really a crisis of confidence? I'm not so sure.
Chase?
I think there is a crisis of expectation.
Okay.
And if you expect the wrong thing of doctors and they don't provide it, then you have a right, you think, to be critical of them. I think we ought to, I hope we get into this question of what are doctors really able to provide.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's quite different than what lay people think they ought to be providing sometimes.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to an excerpt from a discussion on the practice of medicine today, particularly its ethical and humanistic elements. The speakers are Dr. Chase Peterson, Vice President for Health Sciences at the University of Utah, Dr. John Kernute, Research Fellow in Pediatrics at Harvard Medical School and the Sidney Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, Dr. Thomas Ballantyne, Professor of Surgery at Harvard Medical School, William Bennett, Chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, and Dr. Alan Dyer, a professor of psychiatry at Duke Medical Center and a scholar at the National Humanities Center.
Let me intrude, though, sort of sideways, another notion or a way of looking at this. Isn't there an issue of natural versus artificial discipline? Let me explain what I mean. When my father was raised, there was a natural discipline in the upbringing of his family, provided by poverty, which made clear most of the relationships that existed in the family. Did my father at age 8 contribute to the welfare of the family? Of course he did. No one asked him to. It was obvious that he did. That's what I would call natural discipline, and it didn't require any family counselor to tell his parents that he ought to be somehow involved in the well-being of the family. That gave him a sense of belonging and integrity, which was automatic and natural. I'm raising my child now without that natural discipline. And if I want to provide the same sense or same encouragement for the growth of internal discipline in my child, I have to artificially apply some discipline to the family situation. That's very difficult. That's contrived sometimes. Sometimes it's artificial. Most of the time it's successful, I think, in our family. But namely, I have to create from ideas rather than from natural circumstances the notions that my children have responsibilities in the family, because they know that in fact they don't have responsibilities. If they don't do certain things, the family still keeps going along. There are no cows that bellow at 10 o'clock in the morning because they weren't milked, in other words, in our family. Now, in medicine, it seems to me, Tom, you raised this question earlier. One of the reasons that we're wallowing or grappling with the question of medical ethics is that some of the natural disciplines are absent from medicine. What were they? One was the absence of healing technologies. You didn't deal with any of the cases that you now deal with at Boston Children's Hospital 40 years ago in the practice of medicine. The premature babies automatically died, the kids with the juvenile cancers automatically died, and all you did was offer palliation, and there was no ethical issues involved at all. Now, we have those issues, and to me that requires the doctor to operate in such a much wider scheme of things that it would be natural that you'd look around for the guideposts, whereas before, to finish off my analogy, he was sort of walking down a fairly narrow path with rocks on both sides and ropes to hang on to, or these natural disciplines that were there. Does that apply to what we're talking about in ethics at all?
Let me ask John Cornu to comment on that. You talked about the decisions that you make on a day-to-day basis. How do you prepare yourself for that? Sure, you think back about the way you were raised, and you think about the courses that you had in ethics in medical school. Do doctors feel guilty because they have to make these decisions? Do they resent these decisions? Do they come to them and they say, well, I'm going to be a doctor, and I have to make decisions like this, and they get used to it? What?
Well, I'd like to say two things. One is, let me just respond to Dr. Peterson's comment about, you know, expectation. I think one of the best commentaries I've read in many years was by Dr. Lewis Thomas, who's the president of the Memorial Sloan Kettering, who wrote an essay, and I don't remember where it was published, but he was discussing the expectation that people have about medicine, and he traced it back to a very interesting point in history, and that was the discovery of penicillin. And his theory, and I think it's true, is that penicillin really was one of the first medical breakthroughs that offered you a chance to cure a disease. You could have an infection and you could walk in and a person could say, "Doc, give me the penicillin," and you knew that your impetigo or whatever would go away because you got the medicine. And of course, at first that was an isolated phenomenon, and then there were more antibiotics, and then there were more discoveries. And so now I think we find ourselves only partway down the road, that is maybe 20%, I don't know, the other doctors here may know the exact numbers, but there is a growing list of diseases which we are capable of curing, and people can walk into the office with the expectation that they will be cured of this of a particular disorder. But the other side of the coin is, I think, more important, and that is that there are a large number of diseases which are not curable. Yet people do not, in their mind, separate out the curable from the non-curable. They walk in with the expectation that, well, listen, you guys can cure skin cancer, you can cure pneumonia, you can cure certain other ulcers and whatnot. Why can't you cure this particular disease? And that was highlighted by this Apollo phenomenon, you know, the old, if we can put a man on the moon, why can't we do this type of thing? And in the cancer field, it just is almost intolerable, the amount of frustration that people vent upon you, the distress that they have with a diagnosis, and then saying, with the millions and billions of dollars we're spending, we have penicillin, you've done all these other things, why can't we cure cancer? What's wrong with you? So I think when people walk into the office, that this expectation thing is so important. And that was just one point. To answer your question regarding do people resent it, I can only speak for myself in the group practice that I'm in. And I think no one in the group I'm with resents having to make these decisions. Sometimes I think there may even be a danger in a very select few that they may even enjoy a little bit too much being in a position where they have a chance to make these types of decisions. But the vast, vast majority of the people I deal with accept it as part of the responsibility of taking care of this sort of disease. When you make the decision to specialize in an area such as cancer treatment in children, you know what comes with the territory, and you accept it. There are no meetings that we have, you know, together where we say, well, this is going to be our ethical code or anything of that sort. I mean, we all discuss cases on a case-by-case basis, and there are always the intangibles are brought in. You know, the child is from Venezuela. The child's family has no money. You know, is the 5% chance that we can cure the disease worth displacing the family, causing the family to sell their home, disrupt the entire family? These sorts of decisions or discussions go on, and people agonize over them. And I myself have sleepless nights worrying about them. But I think no one shirks the responsibility. People accept them and try to help each other out, but there's no magic formula for it.
Dr. Ballantyne?
Well, it seems to me that the first thing that we have to agree on is that we are a very special group of people. And I don't mean that in any elitist sense. But we come from a segment, both of medicine and the humanities, that is different, that looks at problems perhaps a little bit more deeply. You asked a very interesting question, Wayne, when you said, what about this baby that's dropped in your lap weighing 1,000 grams at 2 o'clock in the morning, and how do you make these decisions, and so forth? Well, I would maintain that the direction in which the physician goes is pretty much autonomic, subconscious, and not a wrestling with the problem very often. I would sort of disagree with it. That it's like driving your automobile. For a while you have to worry about the steering wheel and the accelerator and the brake, but after a while you drive along and you talk philosophy and ethics. The important thing, I think, is to understand that for the majority of decision-making problems that you identified, you're quite right, Bill, it's not a big deal. You make them more or less automatically. But you are, or at least I hope I am, continually revising when I have a moment to reflect on this autonomic response and the subconscious way of dealing with things. I know that in before coming down here, I read an article by Peter Black concerning taking a life, killing versus letting die, in which he injected an entirely different element of to be considered, and that was the matter of intent when the decision was made. Well, that to me was very interesting. I hadn't thought about that before. These are the problems that I think we try to solve, as John says, by group discussions in which experience and reflection is brought into contact with action, because the young man in training is an activist. I think there's no question about that. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. And I don't think, I certainly didn't mean to imply that one sits at 2 o'clock in the morning and rubs your hands together. You don't have time to do that. I think, you know, even the young physician has these autonomic reflexes, but you're a little bit less sure about it, and you force yourself maybe for an extra 60 seconds to think about it before you move into action.
But let me ask this question now. Add up 100 such cases where you made a decision between 2 a.m. and 3 a.m., and what would your judgment be, or our collective judgment, about the validity of those decisions as compared to a situation where you could take those same 100 decisions and spread them out and lay them out on a table and make them very slowly and very deliberately with all the so-called expertise in the world available to you? I guess you know where I'm heading from the sound of my voice.
Yeah, but I would agree. I don't know where you're heading, but I don't think you would really make too many different decisions than the ones that you have to make often on the spur of the moment.
And if most people believe that, I think that says a great deal about how we guide ourselves in medical ethics.
But this simply, I think, says something true about ethics or the nature of human beings when we recognize that they're historical creatures. In the sense, we don't make decisions on the spur of the moment. We've been making these decisions through our whole lives in the construction of character, the development of a certain kind of instinct and reaction. Just there's one quick line came to mind in the middle of this discussion. I throw it out for what it's worth. C.S. Lewis has in his little book, The Abolition of Man, he said, in choosing people with whom I want to play poker, I'd rather play with someone who was brought up and learned that gentlemen don't cheat than play with a sharper who'd been studying moral philosophy all his life.
There's a corollary to that, if I may, in which one of my good friends, who's an excellent investigator, said, never trust the research of a man who cheats at cards.
Okay.
Alan Dar?
Yeah, I agree with these principles about ethics, and it's important that we grow up in a moral environment and that we learn ethical principles early in life and manifest them in everything we do. I think it's also important that we not be too self-congratulatory just because we all here are sensitive to ethical issues. Perhaps we'd have to be a sociologist to determine whether there is a crisis of confidence or not. But I think there is a very real phenomenon that we need to be sensitive to. We do need to listen to the criticisms that we as medical professionals receive and be attentive to what society is saying. Often when I go to cocktail parties or various social gatherings, people will say, what do you do? You say, you're a doctor. Let me tell you about my problem. You're a psychiatrist. Well, let me especially tell you about your problems. Then, doctor, a psychiatrist interested in ethics. And then I'll get some kind of joke. Oh, I didn't realize that the medical profession had ethics, or I thought medicine and ethics were mutually exclusive, something of that sort. This sort of phenomenon to me suggests that there's a very real problem. I used to get very defensive about this. Most of the physicians I know are very responsible, ethical people, and I used to resent this kind of comment. I've learned to become a connoisseur of medical gripes because I think there is something to be learned here, and I think we need to be attentive to what the public is saying about this. Much of it may have to do with something else, as you're pointing out, Chase. I think perhaps a perception of the medical profession as interested in only medical technology or taking an assembly line approach or not taking enough time with patients or not communicating the humane concern that we may in fact have.
You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The center is interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center with an invitation for you to join me this week for Soundings. This week, the center presents part two of The Practice of Medicine Today. My guests are four physicians and a philosopher who discuss some philosophical elements affecting modern medicine and the extent to which technical and clinical advancements influence many of the ethical considerations confronting American doctors. That's The Practice of Medicine Today, Part 2, this week on Soundings.